Well, here we are. And it says on my piece of paper here, talk. So I guess I have to open my mouth and say something. It's hard to do when it's so beautiful and peaceful and quiet. First of all, just so much gratitude for this day and for all of us, and especially for the gift that Connie is giving us, and which we give back in a way as a kind of blessing for your place and your situation and your life. So we are all extremely happy about this and grateful. If it looks like I'm crying, it's just because I have sunscreen in my eye. Usually. I'm struck over and over by this kind of life that we've taken on, this so-called spirituality that looks so much like ordinary life, and yet there's something extraordinarily different about it at the same time. We get up and we go to work and we do what we have to do, but every now and then we come to something like this. Or we come down to Tuesday night and sit, or go to Chikoji, or Spirit Rock. We are so fortunate because there's so many places that we can go now. So we're leading a kind of, when we're in our everyday life, a kind of secret spiritual life, and when we're in a retreat, we're leading a kind of secret ordinary life. It's we can't make those distinctions anymore, really, even though it looks like it. We know that wherever we are what we are. And in some way, we've given ourselves to it, which is why we come. One of the best ways of characterizing it is through one of the most intimate and visceral things that we're involved with, and that is with food. As you saw this noon, what an inspiration it was to fill a bowl with good food and be fed. And for the cook, it must have been an inspiration to have made that food. There is a kind of deep reciprocity in the simplicity of creating and eating food with each other, which is a deeply spiritual practice. It's easy to take for granted, of course, and we can run in and get a hamburger at a fast food place, or run into Togo's and get a great big sandwich, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about how we become the body that we are and live through the body that we are, rather than spacing out in some way. I first started thinking about this when some of you know, I took a retreat in my own house at Christmas time. I stayed home for 10 days, and I sat a real sesshin for 5 days. I got up at 5 and sat off and on until 9 o'clock at night. And I cooked little meals for myself. And I found the cooking of the little meals was something I was very surprised by, because I hadn't thought it would mean as much as it did. Koban always used to say, the food is Buddha, and the servers are Buddha, and the cook is Buddha, and the eaters are Buddha. So it's Buddha all the way. And I really got that when I was doing that retreat. It was, it just shone back in every way, including washing up afterward. I took that experience with me to New Mexico in April for Buddha's birthday. We always celebrate Buddha's birthday in Taos, or outside of Taos. And usually people have to come and go. They stay at home, and then they come during the day, and then they go back home. And they bring food with them. They'll make a casserole and bring it up with them. So the food thing for that those sesshins is a little awkward. But this time, Sue, who has always been always there but always in the background, said she would like to cook the meals. And so we said, oh, that's fine, and we'll have people to help you chop up the carrots, and, you know, you can do this and do that. And she said, no, I want to cook them all. I said, oh, nobody ever does that. Never. But she did. She cooked every meal for a seven-day sesshin, and nothing burned. Nothing was late, and it was the most serene experience for all of us that you can imagine. The Zendo used to be a garage, and next to the garage is what used to be the house of the people who lived there, and is now where we retire, like this, when we're not sitting. And the kitchen is part of the living room. It's just all of one big room. So we were all there. And usually there's kind of whispering and a little bit of chattering and things going on and issues arise. And in this case, she was there. She didn't allow any talking in the kitchen, so there wasn't any talking anywhere else. And it wasn't that anybody minded. Everyone was so happy about it. She gave us that. With her dedication to her total concentration on the food. And so we felt not just fed so we could get back on the cushion and achieve some fantastic enlightenment, but that the whole thing was what we were there for. It was life itself, and a communal life for that period of time. All of us eating and sitting and breathing and smiling and crying together. Been doing this for a long, long time, and it's always been a koan for me how to keep practice clean and ongoing in a very chaotic, sometimes chaotic life. I started sitting when my youngest child was 7. The others were 10 and 12. They were all 3 boys. So it was, just to start with, a very, very exciting life, you could say. And it was always a big question, how to keep faith with it, as well as keeping faith with where I was and what I was doing. And it took a while to realize that it was the same thing. And that wherever I was, that was it. When I first started to sit, we had sesshins about a half a mile from my house. And I could put the boys on the school bus, because we had a school bus in those days, and then go down and sit sesshin until it was time to go home and make dinner for them. And otherwise, it would have been even twice as hard. And at first it felt so weird because I'd go into the sendo, into this powerful, potent silence with the clamor in my head and sit down. And then by the time it was time to go home, I was really quite peaceful. And then I'd go home and, whoa, everything was going on. Lots of drama. And it took me a while to realize that I was pulling sesshin with me all the way up to the house, and I was taking the house with me into sesshin in a way that I realized finally it was the same place. It was where I was. There wasn't any place of it. Whatever was happening here. That's been very helpful. It was especially helpful when we were doing sesshin at Jikoji, and so much chaos was going on there. And the work at Jikoji also. So much work, so much labor. And yet that was it also. Every bit of junk that we took out of that place was a part of our practice. It was Koban's teaching. He was that wherever he went. When we ended up at Jikoji, and we ended up with a lot of people we didn't know who were living there, he invited them all into the Zendo. Please come in and sit with us. And some of them did. Some of them did later. A great many of them did not. But instead of creating our own little separate, pure, perfect little Zen-y situation, we opened it up and made it possible for everyone to be a part of the situation. It was very hard. Very, very beautiful. There's a beautiful little, I guess it's an essay or a talk that Dogen Zenji gave about cooking, called Tenzo Kyokun, which means instructions to the cook. And it's a very curious thing. Some of you have read it, I'm sure. It gives very particular practical instructions about the pots and the pans, about how much rice and how to figure out how much rice to serve. Make sure you know that there are old people who will eat less and young people who will eat more. Those kinds of things before you measure out the rice. Don't just count the people. Count the situation and understand it first. And all through it is running a kind of I guess spiritual is the only way to say it, instructions as well about how to be with a leaf of cabbage. A leaf of cabbage is a Buddha, a 10-foot-high Buddha, he said. Treat it like a Buddha. At the end, he has a little riff on what he calls three... three attitudes. Which a cook should keep. always as she or he cooks. And the first one is joy. To cook with a joyful attitude. A spirit of joy and gratitude and buoyancy. If you think about the monks, the Zen monks, and how austere they seem, that in a kitchen, in a heiji, maybe they're all bouncing around. I don't know. Buoyancy is really up. And of course, that helps, because when you're really up, you're able, so much more able. Your ability runs through your whole body when you're feeling joyful. And there's a feeling that, yeah, I can do it. 45 people for lunch? Sure, I'll do it. Another one is the caring attitude of a parent. To treat the food like your own child, and to treat everyone as your own child. We have that in the Metta Sutta. Even as a mother at the risk of her life watches over and protects her only child, that there is in all of us that kind of parental mind of deep caring, of being willing to, as our own teacher did, plunge into the cold pool in order to save our child. It's what we call bodhisattva practice, being willing to go as far as we need to go in order to do what we need to do, just as any parent would do. And it's often a sacrifice in some way. Often as parents we give up a lot. And yet it's worth it. Sometimes it takes some years to realize when it's worth it, but eventually it all works out. And the last one is magnanimous mind. A mind as big as a mountain, he said, and as deep as the ocean, that can hold anything. Without prejudice, without taking sides. We've been studying the fourth patriarch ancestor on Tuesday evening, and his whole long poem is all about not taking sides. How to live without judgment. How to live a little stepped back. So we're allowing both sides, not just coming down on one, with a magnanimous mind we can say yes to many more things. Dogen said both day and night, allow all things to come into and reside within your mind. Allow your mind and all things to function together as a whole. We have an aspect of mind that's always separating ourselves from the whole. There's me and everything else. There's me and everybody else. And then our function becomes erratic and clumsy and clouded. It's hard to be clear if we're not taking in what else is happening at the same time. We are what's happening at the same time. We're a piece of it, a piece of the dance of it. So much of our Zazen practice is about learning how to open up and take in. There were times at Jikoji when people would come to me and complain about the blue jays because they were so noisy, because they couldn't even take in the sound of the birds into their Zazen. They've measured people who sit, measured the brain waves, and practice sitters can sit and hear noises coming in and take them in and then come right back to the brain waves of Zazen. They'll hear a noise and go out, oh, what's that? And then come right back. People who have no Zen practice, no meditation practice, when they hear a noise, their mind goes out there, oh, a noise. I wonder what that is. I wonder what's for lunch. I wonder what blah, 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 blah. And they never come back. Or it's a long time before they come back. So there's something about this meditation practice when we do it more than just one time, that we learn how to be flexible and to come back to where we are and who we are and be that over and over again. And this place is where our power is. This place is our place of wisdom and compassion. Uchiyama Roshi said, the degree of separation from the reality of life, from the reality of life, appears as suffering and struggling. What we should be truly grateful for is that no matter how much we suffer and agonize, it is only suffering and agonizing going on in our minds. And when we die, this mind too passes away. It's just wiggles. It's just brain waves. So that even though we separate ourselves and suffer, it's not real. And if we're eager for reality and the truth, then we have a way. And we take that way over and over again. So that's my talk. Are there questions? Comments?
Wiggling away and causing separation, creating separation, how that causes suffering. I get that, but I also just wonder if being human is and being impermanent is in itself causes suffering to arise.
It does, of course, and Buddha made that distinction. He said that the suffering he was talking about was not the suffering of breaking your leg or, you know, getting old and sick, because we all do those things, but the extra suffering that we add on top of that, that we get all caught up in feeling that it's not enough, whatever this is, that life is not enough and we want more. More of all the good things and a whole lot less of all the bad stuff. So that we're constantly in this state of agitation, trying to make things all better, failing to realize how better they already are. That the reality is what where we are and what we have or be. First?
Just thought of this when you said that. So our suffering comes not from what, but from why. I'm just asking why.
Yes.
Broke my leg. Why me?
Yes.
Why did it break? Why am I sick? Why did I get that?
Yes.
What did I do to deserve it?
Exactly. Yeah, as if. Anything else? Well, it's 3:30. So we have time for two more sits.